भगवते वासुदेवाय। नमो विष्णुपदाय कृष्णप्रस्थाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामी नित्य नामने नमस्ते सारस्वतदेव गौरवाणी प्रचारणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादि पाश्चात्यदेश चरणे श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव श्री गौर भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे। Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 2, Chapter 8, questions by King Parikshit, text 16. Pramanam andakoshasya bahyabhyantara vedataha mahatam chanu charitam varnashrama vinischayah. Pramanam, extent and measurement. Under koshasya, of the universe, bahya, outer space, abhyantara, inner space, vedata, by division of, mahatam, of the great souls, cha, also, anucharatam, character and activities, varna, castes, ashrama, orders of life, Vinishchaya, specifically describe. Translation, also please describe the inner and outer space of the universe by specific divisions as well as the character and activities of the great souls and also the characteristics of the different classifications of the castes and orders of social life. Purport, Maharaj Pariksit is a typical devotee of Lord Krishna and as such he is anxious to know the complete signification of the creation of the Lord. He wants to know the inner and outer space of the universal form. It's quite fitting for the real searcher of knowledge to know about all this. Those who are of the opinion that devotees of the Lord are satisfied with mere sentiments can find an increase of Maharaj Pariksit good lessons as to how inquisitive a pure devotee is to know things in their true perfection. The modern scientist is unable to know about the inner space of the universal horizon and is what to speak of the space which covers the universe. Maharaj Pariksit is not satisfied with only material knowledge. He is inquisitive about the character and activities of the great souls, the devotees of the Lord. The glories of the Lord and the glories of his devotees combined together comprise the complete knowledge of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Lord Krishna showed his mother the complete universal creation within his mouth while she, completely charmed by her son, wanted to look inside the mouth of the Lord just to see how much earth the child had eaten. By the grace of the Lord, the devotees are able to see everything in the universe within the mouth of the Lord. The very idea of the scientific divisions of four classes of human society and four orders of life is also inquired about herewith on the basis of individual personal quality. The four divisions are exactly like the four divisions of one's personal body. The parts and parcels of the body are non-different from the body, but by themselves they're only parts. That is the signification of the whole scientific system of four castes and four social orders. The value of such scientific divisions of human society can be ascertained only in terms of the proportionate development of devotional service to the Lord. Any person employed in government service, including the president, is a part and parcel of the entire government. Everyone is a government servant, but no one is the government himself. That is the position of all living entities in the government of the Supreme Lord. No one can artificially claim the supreme position of the Lord, but everyone is meant to serve the purpose of the Supreme Whole. Translation, also please describe the inner and outer space of the universe by specific divisions as well as the character and activities of the great souls and also the characteristics of the different classifications of the castes and social life. This is a series of questions in the second canto, which will be answered in detail in the rest of the Bhagavatam. So that is why sometimes the first and second canto are considered both introductory in a sense, though the second canto does have a lot of important information, and it also has the four essential verses of the Bhagavatam given to Brahma by the Supreme Lord himself. So it's a summary of the whole thing. In any case, we have here a whole series of questions which will later be expanded into all the different topics of the Bhagavatam. Previously also, there was a series of questions by the sages of Naimisaranya on different topics, and then Suta Goswami briefly answered those, and those again will be the subject of the Bhagavatam. Here are quite a few specific questions about different aspects of the universe. In fact, the whole geography of the universe, the space of the universe, and then within that space, how the different living entities operate, including the human being. So that is why here we have a request for a description of the Varnashram system, that is for the human beings, though there are so many other animals there also. So, these subjects will be discussed, and these are typical subjects of Puranas in general. So it is also stated later the 10 topics of Bhagavatam, which are 10 topics of a major Purana or Mahapurana. And then at the end of the Bhagavatam again, list is given of the 10 topics. So not only the Bhagavatam, but also other Puranas like Vishnu Purana will also deal with the same subject matters. It has maybe slightly different treatments. We have these different topics, though we understand from the very beginning of Bhagavatam, end of the first canto, that the main subject of Bhagavatam is to glorify Krishna. That's the actual topic in the 10th canto. Nevertheless, it also is a Purana, so it deals with these 10 other topics. So the 10th topic is Asraya, which means the final cause or the final shelter of everything. So that is Krishna. He is the shelter of everything in the material world. He is also the shelter of all the other forms of the Lord, because he is the complete manifestation of everything. So he is the ultimate Asraya. So the other topics, the other 9 topics, are in relation to Krishna. They have their significance in relating to the Supreme Lord. Otherwise, they do not exist. And they have no significance also if we try to implement them separately from the Supreme Lord. Which is actually the modern process. We will accept the universe and we'll try to measure the universe. We will describe the different life forms within the universe, and even we'll try to analyze human society into its different components. So we have different fields of study like astronomy and physics and sociology and anthropology and zoology and geography, etc. And all sorts of detailed studies of atmosphere and earth layers, etc. Significant, of course, in these is there's no a concept of the Supreme Lord. There's no relationship with the Supreme Lord at all. Completely separate. Here in the Bhagavatam, all of these same topics are there, but they're related with Supreme Lord, the Asraya, Krishna. So that is how they become significant in this work. Because they are described in relation to the Supreme Lord, we may find that they look, that these descriptions will not actually correspond to what we see in the modern world, which is prejudice by modern material perspective that is separate from the Supreme Lord. So we look at things in relation to the Supreme Lord, we will have a different vision from seeing things related to the Lord. So separation and relation to the Lord are very important. And consequently, we'll find that some of the descriptions, particularly in the fifth canto, are completely puzzling to us. They were not puzzling to people 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago. But they're puzzling to us. Why? Because we've been educated according to the modern scientific mode, which excludes the Lord. So we have a very limited vision of the material world, and we think that is the correct version. So, of course, scientists will attack that and say, well, we're being, you know, religious and sentimental and superstitious or whatnot. And the very basis of modern science is to exclude everything except careful observation. So this obviously limits our idea of what is real, because it depends upon our present concept of what is real and our limited senses. So our senses, first of all, are quite limited, and then we have our mind also, which has its limitations. So therefore, our whole concept of what is this real world is subject to that. And therefore, we can draw pictures of the universe. We can measure the diameter of the universe, which is something like 21 plus 22 zeros after it, whatever that means. I don't know if that is possible to describe in words. Maybe they have a word for it. I don't know. It's just a huge figure, which doesn't really mean too much. Yeah. In any case, for us, it is very big. That's all we understand. It's very, 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 very big. And it's very lonely and cold because it's full of space, most of it. So that's the conception of the universe according to modern conception. Okay. It's also one way of looking at the material world. And as I said, noteworthy is it is not related to anything. It is just there. That's all. A huge blob. And what's beyond the blob? Nothing. And it just kind of sits there, and that's it. That's the whole of reality, this huge blob called the universe. It's kind of floating, or not floating, I don't know, falling in space forever. With all the galaxies and the planets and solar systems and everything in it going, you know, operating. So that's a concept. We may think, oh, that's the true concept. But we don't know. Yeah. One, of course, is that nobody's seen this. Even scientists haven't seen it. It's all theoretical, because it's only something due to their present theories and formulas that they've derived this type of concept. Also impossible for them to really visualize as such, because it's a little puzzling. What is this? So what is space and what is time? Also very puzzling. We think of space as three-dimensional something or other here. Some people say it has five dimensions. Some people say it has seven dimensions. Some people say it has 13 dimensions or whatever. What does that mean? But in mathematics, they certainly do use many more dimensions than we have. So how do we conceive of it? We can't, at the present time at least. So maybe in the future we can conceive of things in four dimensions or five dimensions, and school children can study that in school, and they can very well see the world in terms of four dimensions. It may look a little different from this world. We don't know. So that's just within the material world and within our present material concepts of what is real. But that's got nothing to do with what we see from the spiritual point of view. So it's quite limiting in terms of theory. In terms of actual vision, yeah. How is it possible for us to see more than three dimensions? We've so much stuck on this three dimensions that it's difficult for us to see. Previously, they didn't even think in terms of three dimensions as such, probably. They thought in terms of two dimensions often. And therefore, you'll see ancient pictures are very two-dimensional, flat. They think everything is flatly described on a flat surface. Then they discovered perspective, and they started to see three dimensions and things like this. But it would seem two dimensions. But Were they primitive or not? No, it's just a different way of looking at things, that's all. So you can describe everything and convert it into two dimensions, or you can describe it in three dimensions, or you can describe it in 20 dimensions or whatever. You have your options there. So but we're just stuck on it. It has to look like this in our three dimensions, and we'll make a globe of the Earth floating in space and rotating around the sun like this, and this is our conception of what is real. And therefore, when the Bhagavatam just gives us a different concept of everything, we said, how can that be so? Because it contradicts our vision at the present time, that's all. And, of course, it looks a little peculiar because it's all described in terms of huge mountain ranges and funny-looking trees and lotus flowers and huge circular oceans, like donuts, round oceans, etc. So it doesn't seem to conform to anything we know in the material world. Yeah. So this is another way of looking at and way of describing something which we cannot describe with our present words and our present vision, that's all. So we should not condemn it as being primitive. We have to just think, it is different, a different type of description. It's obvious that not everybody believes that Earth is flat, as we may think from the Bhagavatam, where it talks about Jambudvipa and Bhumandala, and then it looks all flat. But very early in mathematics, Aryabhata said, no, it is spherical Earth, rotating on an axis. But he didn't give up the version of the Puranas either. He accepted both. So he operated in a three-dimensional reality for some time, said, okay, the Earth is spherical, rotates around the sun, etc. At the same time, he accepted the other conclusion of the scriptures, even though it looks contradictory. Why? Because he understood there's different ways you can look at everything. There's different ways you can describe everything. And it may not be the way we look at things or the way we describe things. And we want to describe things systematically in terms of, and divide everything up in terms of make everything in order. In the Bhagavatam, we'll find things are out of order. The time sequence is often out of order. Things are put in funny, not in chronological order all the time. And things are squished into one time period when they're spread out over a long time period. Huh? Why? Because people were unintelligent? No, it's just a different way of dealing with time. They don't consider time as linear, maybe. So, therefore, we should not look at these descriptions that we find, particularly of the universe, to be so outlandish or far away from reality. It's a different way of looking at the material world, that's all. So what to speak of looking at the world from the Supreme Lord's point of view? We can look at it in the material world from higher points of view, from Devata's point of view, or Brahma's point of view, or Shiva's point of view, or whatever, or a yogi's point of view, which is completely different from our time and space. But then what about if we look at it from the Vaikuntha perspective, or the Supreme Lord's perspective? What does it look like? We cannot imagine. What is it? So that we have to consider when we look at these descriptions. So Parikshit Maharaj is asking this question to Sukadeva Swami, particularly about the whole universe and everything in the universe. So as Prabhupada comments in the purport, that these are intelligent questions that a person will ask. Though, ultimately, the devotee is more interested in hearing the activities and qualities of the Supreme Lord. Much more interesting. That's directly spiritual. So, to hear descriptions of matter and how it comes together and how it divides up into different things and how it combines again is something like interest in chemistry or something like that, where we analyze things and see how molecules and different elements get together and they form into objects, etc. It's matter as such. The point here, of course, is to make the connection between matter and the Supreme Lord. And we may not understand it perfectly. But even if we don't, and probably we can't in the modern world because we're so stuck on our present way of looking at things, still, what we can do is at least acknowledge that its source is the Supreme Lord. He is the final cause of everything. So as I said, we have the Ashraya as the 10th topic of Bhagavatam. He is the source of everything. And all the other topics, such as Stiti, which is largely what is described in these questions here, the construction of the universe with all of its planetary systems and places for the living entities to live, that is called Stiti. So that may be, we can't understand it. But what we can understand about it is it's related to the Supreme Lord. It's very carefully constructed in a very symmetrical fashion, methodically. Another way of saying this is that the laws of science are also methodical, otherwise it wouldn't be laws. So because of those laws, objects turn out with a certain order in them. And therefore we have order in the structures of things due to the molecular combinations, etc., like that. All orderly done in a certain way. And then we have larger structures like forms, like flower forms or whatever, all done with a certain symmetry to them. Okay? Of course, we can say how the symmetry got there in a plant that can't even think or whatever. How does it get there? We don't know. But nevertheless, the symmetry is there in life forms and in non-living things also. We have symmetry in the chemical combinations, etc. Because there's laws behind everything. So there's a law for formation of material things, different compounds formed from elements, etc. And there's also harmony in the forms related to living beings, that is, bodies and animal and plant forms. Somehow there's laws behind that also, so that they form in certain ways with certain symmetry. And that is why we can operate in our body as we do, because there's certain laws there that make things interact in certain ways so that we can use our body. Otherwise, if there's no laws behind it, it would fall apart. So there are things that keep everything together. So we may not understand the laws, and scientifically people may analyze these laws in the modern world, not completely, but to whatever they can. Ultimately, the goal of Bhagavatam to stay behind all of this is intelligence of the Supreme Lord. Somehow he's behind it, somehow or other. Not directly, perhaps, but indirectly. So, now of course we have what is called intelligent design. Is it the religionists and Christians, they have another theory of evolution according to intelligent design. So the Lord is behind the intelligence or whatever like that. Now, we can agree with it some, maybe not directly, but in the sense that the very laws that govern how everything is formed, it's ultimately you trace it back to a lawmaker. And the laws, how are they made? Will of the Lord. He doesn't have to think about certain laws like the law of gravity. How did he make the law of gravity? No, he doesn't have to even do that. He just has to will things to happen, and they happen harmoniously and symmetrically, etc. Because he is omniscient, and therefore his willpower alone can achieve everything. So, another way of looking at it is, as Prabhupada explains here in the purport, Krishna opened his mouth and Mother Yasoda saw the whole universe inside Krishna, which is like a Vishwarupa form, universal form, where everything is part of the Supreme Lord, as we see in the 10th chapter of 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in the Vishwarupa Darshana, where Krishna showed the universe, that he was the universe, to Arjuna. So, in other words, the Lord is the world. He contains the world. simultaneously isn't the world because he's got a separate form. Completely different. He's not matter. But he can also be the world. How can he do that? How can he be the world and not be the world simultaneously? That's the power of the Supreme Lord. Again, inconceivable for us how that can happen. So, Krishna displayed that to Mother Yasoda. She looked inside his mouth and then she saw the whole universe there. What was more surprising, she not only saw the universe there, she saw Vrindavan and she saw herself there also. And she also saw Krishna there. She looked inside and she saw all the planetary systems. She saw Bhumandala, then she saw Bharatvarsha there on Jambudweep, and then she saw there's Raja there and Bharatvarsha, and then she saw herself there and all the cows were there and there was Krishna there, and she saw herself looking inside Krishna's mouth. So that's a completely another perspective. She is looking at herself, looking at inside Krishna's mouth. So, how is it possible? Again, it's the will of Krishna. So, we can think of everything is within Krishna. And Krishna can make that happen if he wants to, as he does here with the universal form. This is what we call a little primitive, in a sense. It's a primitive way of illustrating how God is everything. But Krishna can manifest that if he wants to. At the same time, we understand he is completely separate. And simply by his willpower, everything can happen. He doesn't have to put the things inside himself. He can have them completely separate from himself. And by his willpower, he can manifest all the universes and whatever there are in existence. So, this also shows the interest of the devotee. Parikshit was asking, what does this universe describe it and everything like that. So that is, in the material world, a devotee will sometimes ask this question because he wants to know how matter is related to the Supreme Lord. We have a material world here and we're very accustomed to it. So how does this arise from something spiritual? So that's a basic theological or philosophical question that is asked. How does matter relate to the Supreme Lord when he is absolute? And if he creates it, then how is that possible? Because he creates something which is not perfect. And if that's so, then he must be imperfect. So questions like that arise. So it's a question that may arise for people. So, of course, there's answer to that. And then we have a devotee like Arjuna asked the question. You show how you are the universe and whatever. So then Krishna shows that. Yasoda did not ask the question. Krishna just showed this as a test or a joke. She was not interested at all. What is the universe or how does it relate to the Supreme Lord? She was just interested in punishing her son, that's all. And what was her reaction when he saw everything after everything was over? Then she forgot it. That was not her interest. Her interest was to protect Krishna in case there were some demons playing tricks. That's all. So she was not really interested at all in how the universe is related to the Supreme Lord because she didn't identify Krishna as Supreme Lord at all. She just thought somebody's trying to disturb Krishna, so we have to protect him. So her interest was not in the Lord as the creator at all, but simply not even seeing Krishna as the Lord at all, seeing her as son. He is my son only, that's all. So therefore, she forgot that completely. She had no interest in it. Because she had no interest in God as a supreme controlling entity. She had only interest in her son, who was Supreme Lord, actually. So her reaction was completely different from Arjuna's reaction. Arjuna wanted to see how Krishna was the controller of everything. And then after he saw it, then he regretted his previous friendship with Krishna, treating him as an equal, because he saw Krishna as supreme. So a completely different reaction of Arjuna from Yasoda. So some devotees will be interested, as Arjuna was interested. Other devotees will not be interested. Yasoda was not. She was just interested in Krishna. So, therefore, these topics, other topics, nine topics are described in relation to Krishna. Some people will be concentrating on simply the topics of Krishna in the 10th canto. And nothing wrong with that. And that's what the Raghunuga Bhaktas do. They simply hear about the activities of Krishna. Others will try to relate it to the experiences we have in this material world, with the world we have, and try to explain everything in relation, Krishna in relation to the material world. So therefore we have these other topics of the Bhagavatam. Yeah. So as I said, the main idea here is to relate everything that we can experience in the material world with its cause, and as Krishna. We may not understand everything, but that doesn't really matter so much. The main thing is it's directed back towards Krishna as the Asrai, which is the main topic of the Bhagavatam anyway. Everyone should simply worship Krishna, and they can get perfection that way. So, that's basically the idea behind these descriptions of the universe, etc. Okay. Many, many descriptions here. Well, they see it as Yasoda also sees.
Yeah.
It's not that it's illusory, actually. Krishna manifests it. But it's illusory in the sense that the Supreme Lord does not have a material body, and the universal form is made up of all the planetary systems, etc. So how can that be the Supreme Lord? Well, in that sense, it's not. It's illusory. It's not the real form of the Lord. But the Lord can manifest that form for particular persons, and in that sense, it's not illusory because they actually see it. But it's not his permanent form, that's all. It's a form he can manifest for people to understand his lordship over the material world, if he so desires. It's also a form for meditation. In the second canto, this becomes the object of meditation for the less advanced yogis. Those who are more advanced simply meditate on Paramatma. Of course, this also has to do with the idea of achinta bheda bheda, simultaneously different, non-different. The Lord is the world, so in one sense, okay, he is the universe. This is the manifestation. The more subtle way we can think of it is that Mahavishnu has everything within him when there's a pralaya. So the jivas and matter are all kind of stuck inside the Supreme Lord that, in a very subtle form, not manifested as such. So, and then they come out and manifest. So then the Lord again takes that whole manifested universe and sticks it back inside himself. This is actually in me. Yeah. Sabkaryavad. Well, there's a description in the Bhagavatam in the fifth canto of Mount Meru in the center, which looks like the center of a lotus, and then Jambudweep is the main central area, and Bhartvarsha, our place, is on that. Then there's a circular ocean, a ring-like ocean around that of salt water. Then there's another island around that, shaped like a donut, kind of, a ring. Huh? I think it's Pakshadweep, is it? Something? Anyway, there's different dweepas. Seven oceans and seven dvipas spreading out horizontally, and then there's a big mountain range, and the sun cannot penetrate past that, and then there's a whole another times two, another equal area of darkness, and that's the end of Bhumandala, and then the edge of the universe starts after that, the eggshell, so to speak, or the coconut shell, the universe starts after that. So therefore it looks flat because we have this flat thing. Of course it also goes up in, you know, Svargaloka, Janatapa, Brahmaloka goes up, and then we have lower planetary systems also, then we have the Garbhodaka Ocean underneath. So it's all within a sphere, but we have this kind of flat surface inside it. So based on that, we said, oh, it looks like the earth is flat. That's that conclusion most people will come to when they hear that description. And then they get real puzzled. Well, how can that be? Because we know, you know, you go up in a spaceship or they send up a satellite and they take a photograph of the earth and it's round. So how is this? How is it flat? So, you know, that's why we get contradictory information from the Bhagavatam, particularly concerning the construction of the earth and the universe. And how to correlate that with those two things. Yeah. So I think it's just a different way of describing things. It's a different vision completely. And it may not correspond to, you know, saying Bhumandala is the earth planet. Can't say that. So maybe Bhumandala is Bhart-Varsha, but even that may not be quite proper because it looks peculiar because Bhart-Varsha is just a little sliver there and then we have a round thing here. So what is it actually? And that's the whole discussion, how to correlate these two things, which nobody's done yet, I don't think it's devotees, but it's actually due to a different type of vision. Stars? Most of them are considered constellations. There are nakshatras. So in the Bhagavad was described, there's a certain level where all the nakshatras are, all the stars in the sky are up there. And the planets are considered to be part of Swarga Loka. They're the moving aspects. They move against the stars. They're considered to be in Swarga Loka. Yeah, I think he resides in the first Varsha above on the other side of Mount Meru, let's say to the north, the first northern Varsha. I forgot which one it was, but it's up there. I think it's down here we have Bhart Varsha, Kim Purusha Varsha or something, Hiranya Varsha or something, and like that on this side. Then we have Ilavarta Varsha in the middle around Mount Meru. Then we have three Varshas on top. So I think it's the first Varsha on the top part. Let's say the northern part from our, if we look at it. We're on the southern, we're in the very southern, southern tip of the Jambudweep. Southern and northern, and then there's the northern side, and there's Mount Meru in the middle. So Manus, I think, resides in the upper, one of the upper Varshas. There's nine Varshas within Jambudweep. He presides over the whole of the 71 yuga cycles, or his descendants, actually, because he has both descendants. And then they rule Bhart Varsha. Well, no, he supplies the kings and the dynasties, which are described up in the ninth canto, the last dynasties that go into Kali Yuga and then it disappears. And then the last descendant of Manu is up in the Himalayas now, hiding. And he won't show himself until Satyayuga starts, and then he starts the whole kingship again, Varnashram again. So that's, he's descended from Manu. So in other words, he empowers these kings to set up a Varnashram system in Bhart Varsha. Well, we see the objects move, etc. It's not that the things don't move. There's laws in the material world by which we have movements of objects, etc. Yeah? You have an object, you drop it, it moves. So it's not just that living things move. In fact, atoms are also vibrating. Atoms, protons, and molecules, they also have their own movements also. Because energy forms. Well, it's ultimately governed by the Supreme Lord. Nothing can operate except by the Supreme Lord. But he doesn't have to do it directly, but indirectly. He makes laws by which things happen. Like, why does a flower grow? Why does a plant grow? You know, there's a whole complicated mechanism of why it happens behind that. And things happen. And there's movement there. So similarly, the whole universe has its expansion and contraction. It has a birth, it has a death. Yeah? Creation, disruption. All objects created, destroyed, even material objects. Mountains are created, mountains are destroyed. Well, generally, at the end of Kali Yuga, it's so tamasic that Kalki comes and destroys all the big demons, etc., and then there's a little rest period, and then somehow or other we get a whole sattvic population coming there. I don't know how it happens, but they get a sattvic population, and then the king appears, and he starts off again with his rulership. It doesn't actually say what it is. It's, they're just up there, that's all. It doesn't really say. It's just that in the Bhagavad, it says the nakshatras are up there. It doesn't say if they're like suns or stars or whatever. It doesn't say. Doesn't say, really. Yeah. Ramanuja. Well, that's a big subject. he's a founder of a sampradaya, the Sri Sampradaya, or the main, at least the main acharya for that sampradaya, and he wrote a lot of philosophical works. He's significant because he was the first serious opponent of Shankaracharya's commentary on the Brahma Sutras, since he wrote the Sri Bhasya. To defeat Shankaracharya's commentary on the Brahma Sutras, which was impersonal. So in that way, he began the whole anti-Shankaracharya movement of defeating that philosophy, carried later on by Madhva, etc. So, strict Vaishnava. Of course, they accept Vishnu as supreme, and their philosophy is Vishishta Dvaita, which means qualified monism. So he argues from the point of view of oneness. As we see here, everything is one with the Supreme Lord. So he emphasizes the oneness aspect of everything, and then the difference is accounted for as, the qualification of the oneness, or like a quality in relation to the object. We have an object like a flower, then it has its qualities, like its pink color and its soft petal, etc. So the two are intimately related with each other. If we take all the qualities away, there wouldn't be a flower. At the same time, a particular quality is not the flower. So there's a very intimate relationship between quality and object. The quality is not the object, but if you take the qualities away, the object is not there anymore. So that relationship is one of interdependency, say mutual dependence. And they all cooperate to make the whole. Quality and object. So similarly, everything is one with the Supreme Lord, yet they operate like qualities, like the matter and jiva operate like qualities in relation with the Supreme Lord. And therefore it is one and with qualification. That's his basic philosophy.
Mahaprabhu emphasized two points from each sampradaya. So how we can improve our devotion service? How we can improve our devotional service?
By?
By the teaching of Ramanuja.
Oh, well, he is responsible, as if he was the first person who gave arguments against Shankaracharya. So if we look in Jiva Goswami's work, he often quotes him encountering Shankar's philosophy. So we can follow his arguments against the Mayavad philosophy. That's one thing. The other is his idea of devotees, service to devotees. He glorifies the devotees a lot, so we also have that aspect in his philosophy.
Did you consider the contradiction present in the distant? Some of them were answered by Sadhguru, some of the other distant, and
yeah.
How it's
yeah.
So then, so on,
Yeah. See, they don't explain it. They just describe it as Vishwanath describes it. He says, okay, this means that this is so much distance from this one, that one, so much distance. So they just give you a whole precise description of what's in the Bhagavatam. They don't say how that exists or what it is and how we account for, you know, sunrise and sunset. They don't say that at all. So none of those commentaries do that. Yeah, there's one place that says that. Yeah, yeah. No, it's not there in any of the original commentaries, and I don't think it mentioned any other place. So, you know, because then obviously, then at one time only Brahmas existed. That would be the conclusion, logical conclusion, but that doesn't seem possible. Because then what would Brahma rule over? There'd be no bodies to make, because there'd be no jivas there. I don't know. We maybe have to look at the original text, and maybe they could have even missed something and put something in there that wasn't there. You know, listen carefully. Who knows? I don't know. It could simply mean that Brahma is the first living entity, and since he's the most important living entity, that's all in the universe. He is the first in the sense that he appears from Brahma's navel, so he's first there, first living entity. But every jiva becomes a Brahma first, and then that I don't know. Time is just a mysterious concept that's actually subtle part of Prakriti, or not Prakriti, of Maya, the non-substance of matter. That is, Upadana is the Prakriti, and then we have the subtle aspect of time and karma, which are also inbuilt into the material world, but they're not substance as such. So, it's there for necessary function of things in the material world. Without time, nothing happens. So the material world is not does not manifest unless we have time operating. A necessary relationship. What is it? Nobody really knows. It just creates the perception of past, present, future, as far as we're concerned. That's all it does. But we don't actually know how it operates. So whether you can travel in time or not, obviously, what is time? Because we don't actually know what it is, we can't really say. But from the point of view of in the Bhagavatam, we'll see that time is a little different from what we think it is, because times are different in different places. Svargaloka time is different from our time, different from other times like this. So it's kind of relative also to the place. Well, the perception is different, and also then their length of their lives are different, so it affects their lives. Everything there is affected by that concept of time. So if you jump from one planet to the other and come back to here, then your whole time gets all messed up, because a few seconds there is the millions of years here, whatever like that. So there's obviously some effects that these different time zones have. Yeah. So whether you can time travel or not, that's another thing, go back in time or in future in time. In a sense, yes, because time with our concept of past, present, future is also a relative concept. So if you get in your subtle body, in a sense, you can travel in time. Not in the sense that you can actually go back to a past, but you can see the past, or you can see the future, at least. So in your subtle body, you can see the past and see the future, so you can travel in time in that sense. Huh? You can't actually put yourself there and live there as such, but you could actually see the events there. You can do that. So in that sense, you can time travel. Yeah, not destructive material time. But there's time for lila. because Leelas have to operate within some sort of time. Okay? So they operate within time also, but it's not destructive like the material world time. Yeah, so they have a morning and evening there also, and they have pastimes within that also, but it's not destructive like this time. It's there for the increase of bliss in the spiritual world, and it can change also. If the Lord wants, he can reverse it or whatever he wants to do with it. No. There's no destructive influence of time. They don't speak of galaxies. They only speak of universes. There's billions and billions of universes. That's the equivalent, I suppose, you could say, to a galaxy. Huh? Yeah. Well, if we want to correlate it with the Bhagavatam version in a modern scientific view, then we'll have to think that there are probably stars in the nakshatras in that certain sphere above the planets located in the Bhagavatam, where there's a sphere of nakshatras, you know, on a certain level higher above the earth, above the Bhumandala. That's all. But whether that's actually, you know, the only concept that's actually so or not, I don't know. Because I think the whole concept of in the Bhagavatam is an overlap concept of many things, as Sadhuput also said. It can be the universe, it can be a galaxy, it can be a solar system, it can be the earth planet simultaneously. Same description. Doesn't say that. But I do think it is just is a concept just to give an understanding of how a rotation system, that's all. That's all. So it's a rotation system. How something will rotate around another thing. So therefore we have a chariot with a spoke going to the middle of Mount Meru or something up there, fastened there with the winds of something or other. Goes around like that. So that's there to give us an explanation of how we see the rotation of the sun over the sky or something like that. But very interestingly, it doesn't actually describe why we have a sunrise, because it doesn't go down at any point. It generally goes up in Uttarayana, and Uttarayana goes up and down, but it never goes below the horizon. So then it doesn't have a description of that at all. So what does it mean? That's a very obvious question that the model would have to answer for any intelligent person, even in ancient times. Why they didn't address it, then the question arises. Not because they were less intelligent, but so I think it's just a way of describing the rotation, and it's not meant to describe sunrise and sunset or anything like that. That's my version anyway. We don't even have to discuss it in one sense, because that's, as I said, it's not really significant to preach, you know, that we must preach to everyone about the fifth canto, construction of the universe. You know, the earth is flat and can't believe the earth is spherical or anything. That's not our whole goal at all. It's merely to relate everything to the Supreme Lord. So our only preaching is that you should not separate scientific knowledge from the Supreme Cause, the Supreme Lord. You'll have a different view of things, then it won't be complete. So there, well, we should somehow include the Supreme Lord in there somehow or other. That's all. Higher perception. You use computers, you use so many things. Of course, we have the BI Institute, and they're researching how to, let's say, explain modern quantum physics in terms of Vedanta philosophy is also there. The Bhumandala. Like a mustard seed. Yeah. Yeah, he's on the Garbhodak Ocean. Below, there's a Garbhodak Ocean with Mahavishnu there, and with Garbhodakshaya Vishnu there, and there's Shesha holding up the universe on his, holding up the things on his head, the Bhumandala on his head. Well, it's not so different from Bhagavatam, actually, because the Lord glances over the waters of the deep, and it separates into, you know, the land masses, etc., and then he, by his mind, he creates all the creatures, something like Brahma's creation. Not so much different. And there's a whole causal ocean there also, the waters of the deep. He glances over the waters of the deep, and he separates the land masses out of that, which is like creation of the material elements out of Prakriti in the causal ocean. Well, that's not mentioned directly in the Bible itself, as far as I know. That's somebody's inferred that, probably. But I don't know that it's actually stated in the Bible itself. Well, maybe not a pure devotee. He has to be devotional in some aspects because actually he is assigned by the Supreme Lord to take up the role of creation. So, you know, and as we see, he cannot get any of his power to create unless he gets the mercy of the Lord. So he has to be a devotee of some sort.
Oh, space, yeah.
So
time travel.
Like how to know that we are the one so called the present, you know, that we are not in the future for other creatures that can travel, you know, see us. So, you know, we sort of think like future, present, past, like
yeah.
Bubbles, you
yeah.
know, and then you just go back and see somewhere your past, or you can go further and see the future. How to know that we are the one so called the present? And we are not
that we're the it may be very difficult if there actually is time travel, because then you're the observer, but then would you age also correspondingly into the past or whatever like that? It would be very difficult to figure out. That is a problem with, you know, time travel itself, how it operates, and you could observe things. Yeah, and of course, if you do time travel, that is one dimension, and then there's also dimensions of space, so then you may end up in a place that has, in which you would perceive other dimensions even, so be a little bit, you know, beyond our experience in one sense, that type of time travel, because it would be in a world which is completely maybe incomprehensible from our point of view now, so whether we could exist there or not actually may be a problem. Because we wouldn't be able to process the information in the right way. No. Which is essentially what happens also in the subtle body. People who do astral travel, they have to train themselves to perceive like we perceive, otherwise it doesn't make any sense. Because they have spherical vision, more or less. They see things simultaneously all around, so it becomes very confusing. So they have to limit their vision like a little horse, you know, with those blinds on the side of his eyes. He has to limit himself to one. Otherwise, he'll just have a, you know, massive vision of everything. With also not just sense, but his other senses operate in that way also. So it's very difficult to, you know, experience in that way from our present mode of experiencing. You know? So they have to train themselves to limit their experience. Observational rather than participatory. Though technically you could, in one sense, participate in those events in your subtle body, but we wouldn't say that you're actually there. We say maybe it's the, projection of the events and stored somewhere, like a three-dimensional hologram or something that you could enter into, which is stored in forever in a, you know, somewhere in the ether or something like that. No, just that the people have they can see past, present, future. That's all in the sense. So, if they see the past, they would have to go back to some extent and experience it, you know, in that sense.
You mentioned earlier briefly about the sort of relationship with jiva and matter working together. So what, as jivas and in the spiritual world, we have individual qualities and sort of personalities, and then we have our personalities here that are conditioned from our existence here. So to what degree, if at all, does the individual qualities of the jiva in the spiritual world as a soul affect the qualities that we have as people or personality here in the material world?
We have a neutral state which we can achieve if we're in liberation, where there's no real individual qualities as such. That's when you take away the material qualities of due to mind, ahankara, and our subtle body, and our gross body, etc. And you just get rid of that. You're in a state of neutrality. I'm just free from the material conception. So in that sense, there's no qualities there at all, except that's in the Brahman state. So that's when you simply get rid of the material qualities. So in that sense, we can say, okay, the soul's just got quality of knowledge or perception or whatever like that. But even that is minimized in that Brahman state. So the spiritual qualities only develop through bhakti. If we practice bhakti, then we develop or manifest spiritual qualities. Otherwise, we simply take away the material covering. We don't. We end up in a neutral state of Brahman. So it requires bhakti to manifest our qualities. And if we do bhakti in a certain way, we manifest certain qualities in the spiritual world. So if we worship Krishna now, we end up in the spiritual world and we conceive of God as Krishna. If we worship Vishnu, then we end up with Vishnu in the spiritual world. If we worship Rama, we worship Rama in the spiritual world and Dasya Rasa as a servant. So to some degree, our sadhana actually may be molds our spiritual qualities and perception. He didn't need to, because actually Arjuna has spiritual eyes. So he can see Krishna, so he can see Vishnu. There's no need. To see the universal form, it's explained that the Divya Shakshu is heavenly eyes, that the Devatas, like the Devatas have, because they appreciate the universal form. So then he had to get lower vision to see the universal form. So therefore he saw that, and he didn't see the other vision of Krishna, which is higher. So the Divya Chakshu were actually lower eyes, like the eyes of Devatas. Yeah, well, obviously, spiritually, there's no contradiction in one sense, because no matter how big Mahavishnu is, Krishna's bigger. Isn't it? So Arjuna is the same size as Krishna. So that's right. But that's obviously taking a material concept of dimensions, because spiritually there is no dimensions. Well, actually, there's three states: a deep sleep, a dream state, and a waking state. They're all Maya. They're all under ignorance. They're all bondage for the jiva. So we have the Turiya state, or the fourth state, that is liberation from bondage, no ignorance. Yeah? So it's often described that the material world experience is like a dream, and isn't that it's illusory. Otherwise, we end up with Mayavad philosophy, and that means matter is illusory. But we don't say that. So therefore, it's not an actual dream, but it's a dream, like a dream, in the sense that it's all very impermanent, and compared to our realization state when we realize either Atma or Supreme Lord, then it is, in that sense, illusory, or because it's under illusion, like a dream is under illusion. So therefore, our ignorance of the material world creates a thing that we think it's real, but it's not, you know, it's not the real real. It's real in the sense the objects are real, but all of our experiences and our attachments to things, that's actually unreal. Yeah. Yeah. No, no, no. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So we are actually here. Yeah.
In a state of what? Ignorant perceptions. Not that we have time like your destructive time. Well, he has his free will. At the same time, he has scheduled appearances, which are described in the first canto and second canto lists. And those avatars appear at certain prescribed times. Some of them are, many of them in Swayambhuva Manvantara, some in Chakshusha Manvantara, like Narasimhadeva, and others in Vaivasvata Manvantara now, like Rama and Krishna and Balaram. Vyasadeva said, so they're set more or less. It's not that they appear anytime they want to, anytime. Usually it's in those particular manvantaras, particular yugas, they will appear. That's all set. If the Lord wants, he may have a few variations or alterations, but normally that's the pattern. Yeah, yeah. Every day of Brahma, same list of avatars appear in a particular order. Usually, yeah, I would think, and that's some extraordinary circumstance. Usually, they were wandering within one universe. Yeah. Yeah. Well, relatively speaking, because everybody has to die eventually. In that sense, second canto says that it is almost perfect, except they have compassion for the suffering Levandis down below. That's their suffering. They identify with other people's suffering, but more or less, there's no old age, there's no injury, no sickness, anything like that, but they do die at the end of the time. And so that's their misery. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's their power. Another planet, another dimension, they can control us. That's a specific power given by the Lord. They can do so. Just like Krishna can also control everything ultimately also, but he's in the spiritual world. So the devatas in the material world also can exert their, by their, like Brahma, how does he create material world? Basically by his mind. But it's material. But the potency is given by the Supreme Lord. So devatas has got their potency too. Distribute the karmas of all the jivas to their particular things, you know, like that. Okay, Hare Krishna.